Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It seems about 5 minutes ago, Republicans had it all. The White House, Congress, talk of a permanent majority. Then it fell apart. High hopes collapsed. McCain's hanging in, but the party's in trouble. Now, two young conservative thinkers are making waves with a message that a comeback is possible if the GOP can change. It means talking about the little guy again, they say, and yes, using government to help. This hour, On Point, a new GOP playbook targeting the working guy and gal. Joining me now from Washington are Ross Douthat and Ryan Salam, co-authors of the new book, Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Bill Kristol calls it the political book of 2008. It's just out today. Ross Douthat, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be back, Tom. Thanks for having us.
And Ryan Salam, welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Ross, first to you. What's your sort of broad stroke analysis of what went wrong with the GOP? You're tough on them as you wade into it here. And you are them.
We are them. Well, you know, the toughest criticism should come from inside, I think, because we're the people who care the most about the GOP's future. The Republicans probably shouldn't be taking advice from Democrats who don't have their best interests at heart. But no, basically our argument is that the Republican Party has become a victim of its own success. And our book looks at how Republicans became America's majority party by becoming a working class party, by winning voters who used to be the heart of the old Democratic Roosevelt coalition, working class voters, the famous silent majority that elected Richard Nixon, the Reagan Democrats who made Ronald Reagan, gave Ronald Reagan a 48-state landslide. And basically, we argue that Republicans won those voters on a set of issues ranging from crime to welfare to the threat of the Soviet Union to basically the tax rates and taxation. And that on all of those fronts, Republicans have achieved some, if not all, of their objectives. Taxes are far lower than they were when Ronald Reagan first ran for president. Welfare has been reformed. The crime rate, after exploding for 20 years following the 1960s, has leveled off and then dropped. And obviously, the Soviet Union is long gone. And so it's natural for Republicans like the Democratic Party before them to sort of struggle a little bit at this moment and try and find a way to reinvent themselves. And what we're arguing in the book is that the way to reinvent the party is to look at the new challenges facing the working class, challenges of mobility and insecurity, the challenge of family breakdown among working class Americans, and find new innovative ways to address these problems.
Ryan Salam, as you look at that, you're sort of throwing some grenades along the way. I mean, you say, I'm looking at, I quoted this earlier, but in your introduction, you say the Bush era GOP's mix of neglect and crony capitalism too often appeared bent on pushing the United States toward Latin America, where the rich are rich and the poor are poor, and there's no independent, self-sufficient working class in between. Is that your analysis of the economic state of this country after this period of Republican domination?
After poring over a lot of data, I think that Ross and I have both reached the conclusion that America's institutions and our economic health are in pretty good shape. The problem is that our political leadership fails to understand the extent of anxiety that exists with middle and working class families. And I think that is a really big problem, particularly for conservatives. Because when you look at why working class folks have voted Republican for some time now, those who voted Republican vote that way because they believe in the value of self-reliance. They have confidence about their own economic chances. And when these voters lose confidence in their economic prospects, that's when they begin to despair, and that's when they turn away from this creed of self-reliance, which is a pretty demanding creed. So that's, I think, a political problem as well as a broader problem for our democracy.
So are you saying to those working-class Americans, buck up, just, you know, self-reliance will pull you through? Just don't forget your good conservative ideology, or are you offering something else?
No, in fact, I actually think that's a ludicrous notion. And I think that when you're looking at the Bush White House, they had a group of Americans who believed that, you know, as long as we play by the rules, as long as the rules of the marketplace are, you know, more or less sound, we can thrive, we can flourish. But I think that actually what you've seen happen is economic policy, and this wasn't just under the Bush administration, but you've seen economic policy over the last couple of decades tilting away from the interests of these, you know, women and men for a lot of reasons. A lot of them are structural reasons. They don't have to do with government. So what we think is that government needs to actually help these neighborhoods and these families, but that Democrats don't have the right answers. In fact, the Democrats often exacerbate the problems that these families face.
Ross, and a lot of what we're talking about, mm-hmm. Tom, is essentially helping people who help themselves. We talk about essentially sharpening the incentives and changing the structure of the welfare state, the structure of the American tax system, and so on, so that people who do play by the rules, people who do believe in self-reliance, have an easier time getting ahead. And this is distinct from just, you know, this is not just a question of just sort of throwing tax dollars at the working class, you know, and creating vast new government programs. We're talking about, you know, we aren't actually talking about spending vast new sums of money. America already has a large welfare state. And the way conservatives have always succeeded, whether it was Ronald Reagan or the Contract with America, has been in talking about how to reform the welfare state and how to reshape it to achieve conservative ends.
But you are talking about government helping out at a, you know, a lot of critics of the Republican Party have said, well, in the Nixon years, even in the Reagan years, there was the God's guns and gays, kind of waving the social conservative issues rather than economic issues in front of a big part of the electorate and attracting them to the GOP that way. You're saying that doesn't cut it anymore, Ross?
Well, first of all, I'm saying that that isn't actually how the GOP took power. Obviously, the social issues like gay marriage and abortion played a big role. But part of our argument in the book is that actually the issues that the Republicans campaigned on weren't really symbolic issues. And for years, Democrats have said, well, crime, that's a symbolic issue. Welfare, that's a symbolic issue. Even tax rates, a symbolic issue. Those aren't symbolic issues. Those are, in fact, issues that cut at the heart of working class prosperity in America. It's working class families who bear the brunt of rising crime rates. It's working class families who see their tax dollars going to fund ineffective welfare programs that essentially make their streets less safe rather than more safe. So, in fact, I think our book actually completely rejects that particular liberal critique of the Republican rise to power. What we do say, though, is that precisely because some of those issues on which the GOP has risen to power don't resonate as much anymore, there is a sense in which, yes, right now the Republicans are left just with the symbolic appeals that naturally aren't resonating, I think, and that's a problem for the party today.
And you do go, though, very much to the government role. Raihan Salam, you and Ross write, too many on the right seem to have confused the American tradition of limited government for an ahistorical vision of government that does nothing at all. Are you pointing at the Bush White House there?
I think the Bush White House was quite happy to use government power, but they were happy to use government power on behalf of particular narrow constituencies
They
wanted to win politically. For example, steel tariffs to win over voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia. I think that that was an idea of that was a crude pander. But I think that when you're talking about helping the working class get ahead, helping the working class to become more mobile and have greater confidence in our economic future, those are policies that actually benefit everyone, not just a narrow slice of the American population. I think that, you know, a lot of liberals criticize Ronald Reagan and his tax cuts and his supply-side vision as something that was exclusively for the rich, trickle-down economics. But actually, the thing to understand is that it was a vision of how all Americans could win in a growing, flourishing economy. It wasn't a perfect vision, and those policies weren't always the right policies. But I think that that's what Republicans need. They need a vision that embraces all Americans of all economic classes and of all backgrounds. I think that that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, you quote Minnesota Governor Tom Pawlenty. Of course, he talked about the Republican Party transforming from the party of the country club to the party of Sam's Club. And you make much of the Sam's Club Republican. The target, Ross, that you're aiming at here with the policies, and we'll come to them, but the policies that you describe, the changes you describe, who are you trying to help and in the process bring back into the GOP fold?
Well, when we talk about the working class, we're really talking about a pretty large swath of Americans, specifically Americans without college degrees. There's a lot of debate now about how to define the working class, whether it's better to define it by income or to define it by education. And we come down heavily on the side of education. We argue that education is the real social and economic divide in the United States, and that if you just define working class by income, you end up, say, you know, having a 23-year-old Harvard graduate who's only earning $45,000 a year right now getting defined as working class.
Though so you do describe big sectors of the country getting locked into sort of poor educations by their low economic status.
Well, right, and that's the defining feature of the modern American economy, is the extent to which income follows education, and not just income, really, but what we're talking about is economic mobility. I think we spend a fair amount of time in the book disagreeing with a pretty standard left-wing argument, which is that the American working class has gotten steadily poorer over the last 30 years. We don't think that's true if you look at the range of data, and in fact, we think in certain ways the American working class is doing better than ever before.
But you should describe them as in trouble.
But they are in trouble, and the problem is that the essential character of, to get a little windy for a moment, you know, the American dream is, it's not just the idea of having enough money to make ends meet. If you look at it from that perspective, then yeah, Americans are doing pretty well overall. But it's the dream of ultimately, you know, social mobility, the idea that, you know, if you come from a working class background, you can have the idea that your children won't just do okay economically, but that they can do better, that they can go on to a different walk of life. And a lot of factors right now in American life are pushing America in a more socially immobile direction. And, you know, there are economic trends. There's also the trends in education. If you look at, for instance, the way meritocracy works, you know, in theory, the American college education system, right, is supposed to be a pure meritocracy where anyone from any background, as long as they're smart enough, do well in school and so on, can go to any college they want and go on to do well in life. But in reality, what's actually happened as higher education has expanded is a hardening of the meritocratic arteries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about remaking the Republican Party for the working guy and gal, with two young Republican thinkers who say the GOP needs an urgent reorientation. Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam are with me. They're both with the Atlantic Monthly editors there. Raihan blogs at theamericanscene.com. Ross is senior editor and blogger at the Atlantic Monthly. Their new book is Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It's getting all kinds of rave reviews. Here's Ramesh Ponnaru, another young conservative at the National Review, saying Republicans have failed to become the country's majority party because they've forgotten the working class. He says maybe Douthat and Salam have the solution. And here's a couple of Democrats, John Judas and Rui Teixeira, saying we hope no Republicans read this book, because if they do, they might get an idea of how to undermine the emerging Democratic majority. We'll hear in a little bit from Bob Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, from a little progressive pushback here. But let's get to policy, if we may. Raihan, begin to lay it out. What would you have Republicans in power do or propose that the government do to help out the Sam's Club Republicans you're focused on here?
Well, I think the key thing is family-friendly tax reform. I think that when you're looking at the tax cuts we saw during the Bush White House, they were skewed to the rich. Now, that's not necessarily a problem insofar as the rich really do drive economic growth, they drive innovation, but it's not nearly enough. And I think the tax cuts were too tilted in that direction. You need tax cuts that recognize that investment doesn't just come in the form of capital investments in your computers or in your plant. They come in the form of raising the next generation. And that's something that is very, very expensive. It's particularly burdensome on working women, but it's burdensome on all parents. And I think that when you treat children as just another consumption good, like buying a fancy car, you're not getting at how important it is to raise the next generation and to see to it that they have the educational opportunities and the nurturing that they need. So that's why we think that we need a much, much bigger child tax credit.
You're talking about going from maybe $1,000 now to $5,000 per child.
Absolutely, and I think that's just a first step. I also think that we need to radically revisit the way that we educate children. But I think that certainly family-friendly tax reform is one indication of where Republicans have gone wrong, but where they can return to a key part of their core message, which is reducing the burden of taxes on working families while also winning over new constituencies.
You build it around the family that's got a GOP tenor to it. You're looking at mothers in particular, Ross Douthat. What would you do with mothers, stay-at-home and working mothers? What would you do for them?
Well, I mean, part of what we're talking about here is precisely putting a little more meat on the bones of social conservatism. What does it mean to be a pro-family party beyond issues of abortion and gay marriage? And one thing that we've looked at is the idea that essentially when Democrats champion programs that are pitched to working parents especially, these programs tend to be market-friendly rather than parent-friendly, which is to say there are things like, well, you know, you mandate family leave, so businesses have to allow parents to take 2 weeks off. But ultimately, you federally subsidize daycare. And what those programs do ultimately, though, is discriminate against parents who want a different approach to raising their children. And this doesn't mean... You know, there's a lot of talk among about how, you know, conservatives just want to push women especially back into the home and so on. But that's not actually, one, it's not a realistic model. Two, obviously the movement of women into the workforce is one of the great achievements of social justice in our country. But the fact remains that women are moving into a workforce that was designed with single male breadwinners in mind. They're moving into a workforce where you're expected to start work right out of college at 22 and have a career that continues in unbroken ascent into your 50s or 60s and then you retire.
So concretely, what do you offer?
Well, concretely, you do things like, say, you know, we have programs, veterans benefit style programs that offer subsidies, tax incentives, and so on for people who want to move in and out of the workforce. The child tax credit is actually the biggest part of that agenda because it moves the government from subsidizing one form of parenting, daycare, for instance, towards subsidizing, you know, you can spend the child tax credit on daycare, or you can spend it to allow one of the two parents to take more time off. Mm-hmm. But you can also do things that help. Essentially, you want to move to a workplace environment where people feel comfortable working for 5 years, taking a couple years off, knowing that, you know, maybe the government will be there to help them out during those years off, and then knowing that it won't be that hard for them to get whatever training they need to move back into the workforce once their children are older.
But support reform here that would support parents, maybe mothers, who actually stay home with their kids, it's got a Republican kind of ring to it. What about welfare reform, Ryan? What are you proposing there?
We propose a very sweeping program. We think that the key problem with American poverty is that large numbers of families, large numbers of men and women are excluded from the economic mainstream. That means they're taking part in the underground economy, not because they want to, but because they're forced to. One of the great dysfunctions of AFDC is that a lot of mothers really did work. I think that's something that Americans didn't understand, but they were obligated to work illegally because they weren't able to keep the benefits that they needed to keep their kids healthy and to stay economically secure. So when you saw welfare reform, you saw a lot of people enter the mainstream economy. And I think that that's really important. So now the big problem is when you look at young men, particularly young men who are at risk of being incarcerated. I think that these are folks who need to join the economic mainstream, who need to join this economy that's actually growing and expanding, and not an economy that's actually going to endanger their lives and endanger their ability to pass on wealth to their children.
But you're talking about wage subsidies for those young men and for women coming into from the low end of the wage subsidies. That doesn't sound so Republican.
Well, you know, it is Republican, and I'll tell you why. Because when you're looking at how, you know, the great Republican contribution to the debate over social issues in this country was Dan Quayle talking about Murphy Brown and saying that marriage is essential to raising children. But here's the thing. If you don't have a large number of men who have jobs, who have decent economic prospects, they're not going to be adequately marriageable for the women in their communities and their neighborhoods. That's something that you've seen happen in inner cities for decades. It has devastated those communities, and it has devastated those children. When you see the difference in child poverty between the United States and Sweden, what's driving that difference? Is it big government? It's not. It's disrupted families. There are far more families in Sweden, in France, and Germany where both parents, both biological parents, are still there with their kid when that kid is 15. In America, that's increasingly becoming a rare privilege.
But you're going to fix that by having the government subsidize the wages of the working poor.
What we're talking about, if I could jump in here, is an alternative to essentially the liberal approach to the problem, which is to say, you know, you set up a system, you mandate a minimum wage, basically, and you go to employers like Walmart, for instance, that are employing a lot of low-wage workers, and you say, hey, Walmart, you have to pay these workers this amount of money. A better model would be for government and for the welfare system to be working with the kind of businesses that employ low-wage workers and say, look, if you hire this person, you know, at this low wage, they'll get a slight wage subsidy, and that wage subsidy will diminish as the worker climbs the ranks as their income increases. So there's no incentive. A lot of problems with the old pre-welfare reform system was, as Raihan was saying, it incentivized you not to get ahead.
But you're going to subsidize Walmart's wages to its own workers is what you're proposing here then.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but I think it's a little misleading, and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
Because Walmart...
Sorry, Raihan, misleading the public.
No, not you. I think that when you're talking about Walmart, yes, you are partnering with Walmart, but that's because the benefits of, for example, if you look at a gas tax, why does a gas tax matter? It's because you want to reflect the social cost of a gallon of gasoline. The social cost isn't just what it costs to extract it from the ground, it's the cost of the pollution and the wear and tear on roads. The social benefits of having folks who are not part of the mainstream economy be in the mainstream economy have a decent living wage is pretty high. So why should you punish corporations who are actually giving people those jobs that are getting them on the economic ladder towards prosperity? That doesn't make sense. We think that we should all share in that burden as citizens.
If you look at the original welfare reform, if you look at, for instance, Wisconsin, where the original models were pushed through by Tommy Thompson, among others, it was a case where initially government spending on welfare programs went up. And I think that this, and this is where one of our critiques of conservatism comes in. Conservatives have the right idea, limited government. The problem is that sometimes you do have to spend a little more money in the short term to make a failing program work in the long term. And I think that's we're talking about something similar with wage subsidies, where a government investment in the short run could dramatically diminish the number of people getting government assistance 20 years from now.
So a little less rigid ideologically, but then the question, you know, can it really be paid for within some boundaries that would surely come with a Republican view on this? And there's more here, an immigration compromise, we'll talk about it, more cops on the street, decentralized education. We're going to hear from Robert Kuttner in just a moment as well, but we've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you too. Let's go to Sharon, Vermont, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I appreciate what your guests are saying, and especially the way they're trying to articulate something I think that's been lost by big government Republicans, I guess I would call them. And I just would like to say, I'd like to turn this around and get in the head of the average working American. I'm a Republican now, didn't used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think the message to Democrats as a whole is one of entitlement. It creates a sense in the minds of people that government owes them, you know, a good living, a good retirement. They owe them all these things. It creates expectation, creates dependency, and that ultimately creates societal apathy, I think. Instead, I think I like the message these guys are saying. You work hard. You do what you can. I mean, I work two jobs right now. I have four children.
Mm.
I'm not going to take anything from anybody. As long as I can walk, I'm going to work. And I don't care where I work. And I mean, and I like that message. You do what you can. And government will do what it can to facilitate work and some upward mobility and education. In the mind of the average American, there's got to be the sense of personal responsibility to do what you can to get where you got to go.
But do you think they can come in with a plan to support you in that, Mike, without getting into the same path that Democrats are in? I mean, what's the difference when you get down to it?
I think the nuanced way and some of the careful ways your guests are making distinctions between, for example, a fixed guaranteed wage given to people at the bottom, they always know what they're going to get. I've lived in that culture. I'm in Vermont now. I've lived in South Carolina for many years where a lot of people, I know Vermont has a lot, but a lot of people, they become apathetic. They know they're going to get the check. They don't care. They don't have any vision of themselves. They're not encouraged. You know, it's very depressing to see.
Mike, we've got it, and I appreciate your perspective. Let me get one more call here from Topsfield, Massachusetts, and Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Look, these guys are not Republicans or Democrats. They're new wave. They're something different. The Country Club Republicans aren't going to buy this. And the out-of-touch Democrats aren't going to buy this. These guys, this is the third party. You know, they can pull from each party, but this is a new way of thinking for government. And, you know, the out-of-touch Democrat, and I'm a Democrat, but the Country Club...
you say neither party's going to buy this. They have got to start their own, Jerry, and we hear it. We hear it. I thank you for your call. Ross, how about it? You hear support there from Mike, who's turned Republican, says you got the right idea, but Jerry's saying there's no way that, you know, the big, let's say, corporate, or as he calls it, country club end of your party is going to buy this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first caller, his point about drawing distinctions was a great one. I think one of the things that we talk about in the context of the Bush administration, and you mentioned compassionate conservatism earlier, and compassionate conservatism was in a way an attempt to do what we're talking about, move the Republican Party in a more pragmatic, reformist direction. But the problem is that the language of compassion strikes exactly the wrong note. That's the language of liberalism. America already has a liberal party. It already has a party that sees government's role as, you know, to feel sorry for the poor and to help them out with pity, essentially. And we talk about the idea of respect conservatism rather than compassionate conservatism as the model that conservatives have to follow, and the model that's driven past successful conservative reforms. As to whether, you know, look, every party has its interest groups. The Democrats have increasingly a lot of business interests backing them as well. And there's no question that any substantive policy agenda, you know, has to go through a party apparatus that's corrupting in certain respects. I will say, though, that, you know, if you look at, I think, one of the rare domestic policy successes of the Bush White House, and I actually didn't think it was a success at the time. It just shows you how complicated policy can be. But was the expansion of Medicare to cover prescription drugs. And at the time that passed, people on both the left and right were talking just like the second caller. They said, look, this is, you know, a classic Republican Party policy. It's, you know, it's big government, but it's just going to reward business interests. And it's true. The bill was large. Started with probably too many giveaways for business interests. But at the same time, it was an expansion of a program that managed to inject a real free market element into it that helped to drive down costs. And 3 years later, a lot of people left and right say, hey, it was, you know, it had some problems, but it was a pretty big success. So look, politics is the art of the possible. You're always going to be compromising with one group or another. And you know, when Bill Clinton set out to reform the Democratic Party, there were lots of problems along the way. And the same would be true of any reformist Republican Party. But I think we've got a ways to go before we throw things out and start a third one.
Let's get a quick call from Salt Lake City, Utah. Ryan, you're on the air with Ross Douthat and Ryan Salam.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just wanted to say, I think one of the ways we could return Republicans to a majority is by actually doing what we say and sticking to our core principles. One of the biggest things for me is spending and actually reducing the size of the federal government, which Republicans have not done in the past, I don't know, couple of decades.
Do you think you can reduce the size of the federal government and deliver on the kind of promises that these guys are suggesting, Ryan?
I do.
Subsidies? I'm sorry. We're both named Ryan, so I'm probably...
Ryan in Salt Lake City, do you think it can be done?
I would say... Do not allow the subsidies. However, the tax credits, I always want to see them reduce taxes. And the way you reduce taxes, reduce spending. If you're overspending in Washington, they've got to get the money from somewhere. They either tax the people or they print it. And that is another form of taxation through inflation. I mean, it's the reason why we see our dollar tanking at $4 a gallon gas. That's not because of demand in the world. That's because the dollar's bottoming out.
Yeah, Ryan, let me put it to our Ryan. Ryan Salam, we just got 20 seconds before a break here, but can you really do all these things and observe the kind of spending restraint that our Republican caller from Salt Lake City is looking for?
Yes, you can. The government can't do everything, but what government can do is create the right incentives for working families to flourish.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a couple of young conservative thinkers out with a book that's turning heads in the Republican and Democratic parties. Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam join me. Their new book is Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Something new for the GOP, they say here, and something that might work to swing back the what they call Sam's Club Republicans, working class men and women, get them firmly back in the Republican column. And they say that things have strayed way too far from a sharp eye in the interests of those people. They join us from Washington. Joining us right now from Truro, Massachusetts, is Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of the magazine The American Prospect, author of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. He's got a progressive eye and ear on all this and has been listening and reading a bit. Robert Kuttner, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
So here, Rudy Teixeira is saying, watch out, Democrats. If the GOP follows this line, the Democrats are going to be in trouble. They're going to steal the Democrats' supper, steal their voters. What do you think of what you're hearing, Bob Kuttner?
Well, I agree with a lot of the diagnosis of the Republicans having abandoned working Americans, but I think a lot of the program is wishful. Let me say a brief word about both things. It's certainly true that the Republican coalition has been a kind of a marriage of social conservatism that appealed to working class voters on issues like guns, gods, and gays, with a program for Wall Street when you look at who the financial part of the program served. So, point taken. It's also just a delight to hear a couple of young conservatives say something kind about Sweden. And I want to come back to that in a moment.
The universe is not cracked in half, but it was sad.
But I think here's the problem with the program. You cannot do this stuff on the cheap and expect to benefit working class people. And of course, the problem with Bush is, you know, it reminds me of the old British expression, horse and rabbit stew. The Bush program has been one horse and one rabbit. The horse is the stuff that's been done for Wall Street. The rabbit is the stuff that's been done for working Americans. And if you invert that, or even if you try and bring balance to it, it's going to cost money. And that runs smack into the problem of the deficit. It runs smack into the problem of most Republicans not wanting to use government proactively. Whether you call it a tax credit or whether you call it a direct subsidy, it's the same thing. So I think what you end up with is kind of Democratic program light. And I admire their willingness to criticize their own party. I've criticized my party certainly over the years. But I think if you add up all of the things that working families need that they haven't gotten in the past 30 years since Reagan, and this isn't just Bush, by the way, this goes right back to Reagan, it's expensive, and I'd be happy to talk about that in more detail. If you want to find a place that does this right, you're really talking about places like Sweden and Denmark that spend a lot of money on wage subsidies, spend a lot of money on worker training, spend money on family parental leave as well as family money on high-quality daycare. The only problem is to do that, and these countries, by the way, are thriving. They're prospering economically as well as socially, but it costs you 50% of GDP. And where are you going to find Republicans who are willing to raise taxes to that degree or are willing to repeal some of the tax benefits that have gone to the very rich in order to pay for programs that help the poor, whether they're programs done as tax credits or as direct subsidies? So I think there really is not a Republican version of this that is likely to pass muster with most Republicans. And it reminds me of the Nixon era, when Nixon basically embraced a lot of the New Deal's ideas but tried to put a Republican spin on them. The Democrats had set the agenda. The Republicans tried to make it their own. I think this is an admission that conservatism is at a crisis, and the Democrats have now been able to set the agenda precisely because of the frustrations of working Americans. And so if Republicans are going to recoup, they need to move more in a Democratic direction.
Let us put it to them, Bob Kuttner, to Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam. Ross, first to you. I mean, you do paint the stakes in large and threatening terms, the American dream itself under growing threat, you write in Grand New Party. You've got big ambitions here to help a lot of working people. Bob Kuttner says you can't do that on the cheap, and if you try, you'll end up, you know, neither accomplishing your goal, and you can't do it with the Republican constraints of principle on limited government.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of this boils down to, you know, we do use serious language in the book. I mean, we think that there are real problems facing working America, but we don't think that there are problems that you need to spend 50% of GDP to solve. And I think that when you do spend 50% of GDP, and this goes back to no doubt deep-seated disagreements between Bob and myself, but, you know, Sweden has a lot of advantages. It has a lot of disadvantages, and Sweden is also an ethnically homogenous society that's right now struggling with its first sort of multi-ethnic crisis with integrating immigrants into its welfare state. But sorry, I don't mean to go off on a Sweden tangent. But the deeper reality is, look, you know, it's true. We are
describing big problems, and you name and frame them as big problems. Can you address them effectively, not in an eyewash way or just prettied up for an election season? But you're serious here. Can you address them seriously and stay within the kind of spending constraints that I would think a Republican view of the world would require?
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, we won't know until we try. But I think that, I mean, part of what this comes down to is, you know, if you look at some of the successful reforms of the last, you know, in the last segment when I was talking about welfare reform, and I was saying, you know, in order to have an effective reform of the welfare system, you had to spend a little more money in the short term to reap benefits in the long term. But you didn't have to spend a lot more money. And if you go back to 1994 and look at, you know, what I suspect Bob Kuttner was saying at that point, he was saying, well, you know, the crisis of American poverty is such that we need to be spending 50% of GDP to deal with it, or there's no point in trying at all. But in fact, with a much more targeted and a much more narrow intervention in the welfare system, you had falling welfare rolls, you had falling poverty rates all across the 1990s. And I mean, Raihan and I remain Republicans because we believe in the basic Republican vision, which is that economic growth should be the number one priority of government. Economic growth ultimately benefits all Americans. And if you look at the successes of the 1990s, they were a combination of targeted reforms, narrowly targeted reforms, and policies that promoted large-scale economic growth. And I think that that's, you know, we talk a lot of in the book about the sort of idea of America and American exceptionalism. And part of American exceptionalism is an idea that, you know, you have a smaller state than you do in Europe, and you have greater personal freedom, and people are free to do what they want with their tax dollars. And it's absolutely true. We're trying to thread a needle here. We're trying to have targeted reforms that help working-class Americans get ahead without turning the United States into Western Europe. Maybe that can't be done. I certainly think it's worth trying.
Raihan Salam, let's try and put a number on it here. I mean, again, you and Ross write that, you know, there's been too many on the right, you say, had this ahistorical vision of a government that does nothing at all. Now you're proposing that the government do some very specific things to help working Americans. Bob Kuttner says if you got serious about it, it might be 50% of GDP that would be required to really address the sort of built-up closet full of needs. If it's not 50%, what number, what price tag do you put on your programming?
With all due respect, I think that's a slightly silly question. I think that it would be smaller than that, but I think that what you need to understand is that the American welfare state is bigger than it looks. Why is that? Because we have something called the invisible welfare state of tax subsidies that is much, much larger than even if you're just looking at entitlements. So I think that when you're looking at Sweden, which I think is a great model in a lot of ways, what you see is that center-right parties reformed the social democratic welfare state in the 1990s and 2000s. The same thing happened in Denmark. The same thing happened in Iceland. I know that we don't want to get on too much of a Scandinavian tangent, but it matters, and here's why. In Sweden, you saw a radical revolution in schools that led to far more school choice. This was fought tooth and nail by the political left. And the reason why I mentioned family structure in Sweden is that when you're looking at the strength of these societies, what is the source of the strength? Is the source government, or is the source the fact that families remained intact? In the United States, we have a very different situation. We have a situation in which we had a history of enslavement and segregation that deeply damaged American families. And that's why we need to do a lot of very hard, very expensive, difficult work to rebuild inner city communities and rebuild the society.
With respect in return, I have to ask, I don't think it's at all silly for American voters to ask, what is your program going to cost? That hardly sounds silly. It sounds fundamental. If it's not 50% of GDP, what is it? Is it different from what George W. Bush has spent? What is it?
I think it is. I think it's different because I think if you look at George W. Bush's spending, he barely increased spending on the domestic side.
So put a number on it. If it's going to be expensive, what broad number or range are you estimating here?
I think it will be roughly the amount of government as a share of GDP that you saw in the Clinton administration, which is to say a shade under 20%.
Bob Kuttner, will...
Well, that's just what it is now. The only difference is your spend is about 20.3% the last time I looked. The only difference is you're spending it more on the military. I don't think we need to spend anything like 50%. I mean, I'd like to see federal spending be 22 or 23%, because I think that's what it would cost to have some programs that would make a difference in people's lives. But I think to the extent that Ross sounds like anybody in recent political memory, he sounds like Bill Clinton. And I think that's what's going to be a hard sell for this program with the Democratic Party. I just want to take quick exception to one other thing.
Well, you're holding Bill Clinton then up as too middle of the road, too much the triangulator. But isn't Ross trying to sell this to Republicans foremost?
Sure. But I mean, I think there's so much of the Republican Party is a coalition of the most affluent with social conservatives. And Ross is right that the working class person on issues other than guns and gays get squeezed out, but I just don't think at a level of spending that's going to make more than a token difference. I think that's our big dispute. He's ever going to sell this to the Republicans, and I think it's no accident that he's ducking the question of how much is this actually going to cost, because to do this in a way that's seriously going to help people costs money. And I would certainly take issue with his view that working class people have not taken it on the chin for the past 30 years. Every reputable economist will tell you that the real income of the bottom two-thirds is no better, and in many cases a lot worse, than it was 30 years ago, and that's taken a particular nosedive since the year 2000.
You know, our time is so short, I want to get a couple more callers, many waiting here to get in. In Nashville, Betsy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is with respect to the idea of subsidizing jobs through the employer.
Subsidizing wages, yeah.
Yeah, right, the wages. How could this possibly work when our economy is so much now retail and service sector, where that's really based on a model of having many, many, many low-paid jobs and very few opportunities for people to increase wages and move up the ladder? That's my first question. And my second question is, or just a comment, I hear an awful lot, you know, in the talk, especially from the Republican side, about the attitude of entitlement of poor people. And I would like to say, as someone who's worked my whole life, I think it's not an attitude of entitlement as much as it is people become disillusioned and give up. I think the attitude of entitlement tends to reside more at the top, at the very top of our large corporations.
Betsy, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Ross, what about Betsy's question? She, you know, you say let's subsidize wages in part. She looks out on an economy that's got an awful lot of low-paid, let's say, retail workers in it, and that looks daunting to subsidize that much of the American population. How many? How big?
Can I kick this one over to Raihan?
Sure, Raihan, please.
I think that when you're talking about wage subsidies, well, first of all, I think that when you're looking at the service economy, actually, the bulk of service sector jobs are white-collar jobs that have actually been driving middle-class prosperity. When you're talking about those low-end retail jobs, those are entry-level jobs that help people get into the mainstream of the economy. The reason why wage subsidies matter is to draw people in who are outside the mainstream economy into the mainstream legitimate economy. And so I think that those jobs, which we often look askance at, you know, can actually help people learn the skills that they need to flourish economically.
How many million Walmart jobs and their counterparts would you subsidize wages on?
I would say the number that you know, kind of I've worked from is this idea of spending about $180 billion a year. Now, how many jobs that would affect, it's hard to say because, again, there's going to be a sliding scale and the economy is going to change from year to year. So it's not entirely clear how many actual jobs in terms of millions of jobs that's going to affect. But what it will do is actually make a really big difference in inner city communities.
$180 billion.
But to go back, I mean, to go back to Bob Kuttner's point, I think the program of wage subsidies, and I think this gets at what Raihan was saying about Sweden, the program of wage subsidies and a couple other things are real cases where we're talking about about increasing government spending. And I mean, I think that if we're really sitting here quibbling about 20% versus 22% of GDP, then I think we've actually achieved a remarkable bipartisan consensus.
Unity
in the
is broken
but
out.
The broader point is that you can accomplish so many things by moving money around within the current budget.
Exactly.
That and so many of the things we're talking about, you know, and also on stuff we didn't get into, like healthcare and education, and what Raihan was talking about education reform in Scandinavia. These are cases where you're not talking about, dramatically changing the size of the United States government. You're talking about changing its shape.
Would you have to dramatically change our foreign policy? Would you have to dramatically reduce military spending, for example, to achieve what you're describing here?
I think when you look at John McCain and you look at the way that he's tried to target pork and waste in military spending, I think that is a real target of opportunity. I think that the key problem is that you've seen large amounts of money channeled to insiders and people who have favorable access to the government. And that's why when you're talking about, for example, Bob Cutter, someone I very much respect, has talked about industrial policy. But the thing is that Democrats will not always be in charge. Sometimes Republicans will be in charge. Sometimes your political opponents will be in charge. And will they spend government money that's designed to be targeted to favored industries and other sectors wisely? I don't think they will. And that's why Ross and I are both believers in limited government. There are things government can do well.
Bob, yes, we just got half a minute. Bob Cutner, what do you say?
Well, you know, $180 billion on active labor market policy. Yes, my God, that's fantastic. I would be thrilled if Barack Obama, let alone John McCain, proposed that. I think if you proposed that and you got 10 Republican votes on a good day, it would be a miracle.
Bob Cutner, that's all we've got time for from the American Prospect. Thanks so much for being with us. Ross, great to have you, Bob. Ross, Ryan, what about Republican leadership response? I see all the blurbs on the book. They're fulsome, rich, and kind of dancing about this. But are you getting a depth of support here for this? Do you think you've got a party behind you that would really dance in this direction?
I think we are getting a lot of support, and the reason is that you need to look at government as a set of broad opportunities. There are areas where we're wasting our money and we're wasting our resources because there are things that should be handled by the states and by families and neighborhoods. But I think that there are a lot of other areas we've neglected where the federal government ought to take the lead.
But if you're asking whether we're being called in to meet with the Senate leadership every day, the answer is no. I mean, but I think, look, you know, the Republicans have lost. We've only lost one election. It takes a little time for parties to change. It took the Democrats arguably 25 years. Hopefully we can do it a little faster than that. That's what we're trying to do.
Ross Douthat, Raihan Salam, their new book is making waves. It's called Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us, Tom.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.